Good morning.
Good morning.
Silence. A good topic, I think, for Sashen, since we have the signs here and there in the building, reminding us, you know, to be silent during Sashen. I want to take a look at that. Why silence? You know, we don't read, don't talk. Of course, maybe you do talk, and nothing happens. So then we think, well, I can talk. So then you talk a little more. You know, nobody gets after you, nobody scolds you. It's very easy to start to slip, and we become noisier and noisier. Man, what Sashin is about, becoming quiet. And so we need to look at that. But why do we want to do that? Why this matter of silence? Why is this employed when it's so different from what we normally do? Normally we talk, we make noise, we interact in various ways. What's going on there? What is this practice anyway? We'll take a look at that today. This thing about silence at Sashen, I've said this before, that, you know, during the breaks, particularly during the work period, you know, you want to be very careful of that, that you don't talk. Of course, it might be that you're working with somebody and maybe you need to talk. You know, you need to exchange something or other. Could you please hand me that or whatever? Well, these kinds of exchanges, I've talked about this before, they're okay. You can do that. But pretty soon we're commenting on how we feel or with the weather or something else. Something extra doesn't need to be said. And in particular, when you talk about yourself or some personal motive or feeling or idea, just something you want to express, you want to watch for that. But if you think, well, Sashen brings up a lot of stuff, you know, and I need to just kind of, you know, let off steam here a little bit. I need to just express it. Well, I understand that. Well, if you have to, well, then, you know, I suppose maybe just go ahead. But realize you're doing something counter to what the Sashen is set up to do. Maybe you should look at that, because what you're doing is disturbing your mind. You can talk, say, please pass the scissors or whatever it is. You can talk in these ways, and it doesn't disturb your mind in the way it does when you say, I think the breaks are too long, or the breaks are too short, or something like this. Can you feel the difference there? There's a difference that's occurring. One is just simply matter of fact. You can go on, and no disturbance. You need the scissors, thank you. You go right on. The other one is opening up a whole universe here of thought and feeling. And we begin to express it, and it invites the next person to say, oh yeah, you know, I agree, or no, I disagree, or whatever. And things immediately just start to build. You're forming yourself. Your ego is developing here. You're reinforcing that. Well, of course, this is what we do all the time. So we come to Sashen already pretty well with a reinforced ego, you know. And out of that, we want to speak and act. But you should realize what you're doing when you do that. You should realize the rare opportunity provided at Sashen for you now just to make this effort now and just let it go. So easily we speak, we say something, and then we feel, oh, I've blown it. I've stepped off here. And then we let that disturb our mind. You know, all you have to do is, in this moment, when you catch yourself, just stop. To see if you can do that. No further comments needed, either internally or externally. Just let it go. This is very important. Well, I want to explore this a little bit, and maybe we can bring out why this is so. Wasn't it the Dalai Lama who said something about you need to learn the rules so that then you can break them appropriately or something like that. We need to understand this matter of silence, because then if we know how to break that silence appropriately, we can actually maintain silence much more easily and probably help us get into a more proper session. Well, I'm going to read this little story and just kind of use it to help us discuss this matter of silence. It's from Jim Longimo, brought me back to this book a bit after a long time. I haven't really picked it up, but it's a great little book, Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. A lot of wonderful little stories in here. Well, this is a story about, titled Learning to Be Silent. It's about four monks of the Tendai school who vowed that they would maintain silence for 7 days. So here's the story. The pupils of the Tendai school, that was, it says right here, was in Japan before Zen came to Japan. So this is before the time of Zen. The Tendai school, very interesting teaching, very deep teaching in that school. Basically, it has the notion that everything is a manifestation of suchness or thusness. This is Tendai kind of thinking, but it precedes Zen. Anyway, so here the pupils of the Tendai school used to study meditation before Zen entered Japan. Four of them, who were intimate friends, promised one another to observe 7 days of silence. On the first day, all were silent. The meditation had begun auspiciously. But when night came and the oil lamps were growing dim, one of the pupils could not help exclaiming to a servant, "Fix those lamps." The second pupil was surprised to hear the first one talk. "We are not supposed to say a word," he remarked. "You two are stupid. Why did you talk?" asked a third. "I am the only one who has not talked," concluded the fourth pupil. Yeah, well, this is, you see how once that's breached, you see, and where does it go? Immediately begins to tumble down here. Well, let's just take a look at this. And I think out of just looking at what's going on here with these four guys, I can learn a little bit about this matter of silence and why keep silence. Do you suppose they really understood what they were doing when they vowed to keep silent? Probably not. Why would you want to keep silent? Well, it helps if you know. So it might help you if you know. You get a better sense. Not that I want to give you any ideas, but if you have a better sense in your heart of what this is, then it's easier, perhaps, to keep silent without getting too uptight about it. So anyway, this little sesshin begins auspiciously. They're keeping silent. Yeah, that first day, pretty easy, I guess, not too bad. At the end of the first day, the oil lamps are going down. So finally, one of the monks, he exclaims to the servant, "You know, fix those lamps." Well, was that really necessary? You're going to keep silent. Why did he need to speak? Why did he have to say something there at that point? What is he thinking? We don't really know, but perhaps he has a sense that, well, things have to be a certain way. Night is coming on now. We need to have the lamps lit. You know, they need to be kept lit. So fix those lamps, running out of oil, whatever. Well, couldn't you just let the lamps burn down and go out? Sit there in silence, in the dark. You know? Couldn't you get up yourself and fix the lamp? Many ways that this could be approached. But I think what's interesting here is just to look at the mind that would concern itself in this way, fix those lamps. Perhaps it's a mind that's concerned that things are done properly. They have to be a certain way. There's a right way to do things. and we enter into the work period during Sesshin, we might think that this work period is about getting the work done. That's the whole purpose of getting the work done. So that there's something very concrete, very real, very graspable there. Here's the job, and it's to get to this point over here, to get this finished. Get the walkway clean, or the windows clean, or whatever it is. If that's our focus, well, if you just look at what's happening there, this is really quite different from what we do in Sesshin. Because there we have this objective there, this thing that we're going to get done over here. So something is formed there in our mind, a finished product of some kind. And of course we have formed as well. And then we act in such a way to bring that about, to get to this end, to get that accomplishment, to finish this task. But this is Sesshin. Of course, if we're thinking like that now, then we're also sitting the Sesshin, perhaps with the same kind of idea. That I am sitting here now so that I will get to the end of Sesshin. And then what? Maybe enlightenment. Maybe not. Well, then I just got one Sesshin off my checklist here, and I know I got to do some more now. But I'm on my way, marching on my way toward some end product. Well, what would that be? Enlightenment? Or maybe it's death. Yeah. We live our lives in a way we're kind of just always looking for the next moment, the next moment, as if what we're really ultimately looking for is that final moment. We just wave goodbye and we're out. Gone. That doesn't seem quite right. Well, if it isn't for that, if it isn't always for reaching for that next moment, well, then what is it about? And if that means that while we're working here, that this isn't about, say, washing the dishes, if in washing the dishes it isn't about having clean dishes, then it's not that it isn't about that. That's probably going to an extreme. But if we think that this is it, we're washing these dishes now so that we'll have clean dishes later, then we are not here. We're acting for something that doesn't exist, that future moment. That doesn't exist. Of course, we need to take care of that future moment right here in this moment. Then that future moment is taken care of. Yes, we have clean dishes. When that future moment arrives, as we think. We never notice, though, that the future moment never really arrives. This matter of doing the dishes isn't for the future. It's for this moment right here. See, that's a very noisy way. That's not silence. That's a very noisy way of doing the dishes. Noisy in your own mind. You know, Kagyu Roshi used to tell this story. I've told it here. I haven't told it recently, but I remember somebody once sent him a letter, I think it was, and it was a story, and he really loved it. About St. Francis hoeing the garden. Maybe you've heard me talk about this. Story of St. Francis hoeing the garden. Somebody asked him, what if you knew? Not that you just believe, but you knew that the world would come to an end tonight. What would you do? And St. Francis said, I would finish hoeing the garden. St. Francis, if this is true, it might be apocryphal, but if this is true, you see, then St. Francis understands this mind of being in this moment, doing this not for some ulterior purpose, not for some later reason, not for something you're going to get out of it later on down the road, but doing this right here in this moment. And of course, in learning to do this right here in this moment, well, yes, that future moment will be taken care of, but never mind that. It doesn't exist. So let's take care of it now, right here in this moment. Because this is where reality is. So as we enter into, say, the work period, we're working just to take care of this moment. This moment, of course, is the past and the future and the present altogether. So we are taking care of the future, taking care of the past by entering into this moment and taking care of this moment. And when we enter into the task at hand, the work we're doing in this moment, in this way, this is to maintain silence. Right there within our own mind. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're talking. Maybe you need it to please pass me the scissors. That talking can occur right there. But it's not talking. Not when we say don't talk. So in this way, if you maintain a mind like that, you can talk without talking. Without forming yourself here. Pulling yourself out of the moment. Thinking that this is to get something else done over there at some other point, some other time, place. That's what meditation is. That's what this practice is. Speaking of the work praise, when I was in Japan, and we'd have the work praise there, which we would have, I guess, every day. Oftentimes, you know, like day after day, he'd clean the same room over and over again. Every day. It's not even dirty. You clean off this surface here, whatever. Every day. Over and over again. Not just you either. Several people, you know, working together. But I also saw monks get into kind of a panic, just racing around looking for the next thing to clean or whatever when the assignment was to clean. That's just getting kind of caught up in the idea of you have to do, have to clean, have to. And you have to show enthusiasm and energy and get into that. Well, that's good, yeah, but I think we can do it without panicking. But it's a matter of really understanding what it is that we're doing. And we're not doing it just for the sake of having it clean. Of course, it will be clean. Very clean. And that makes it very nice for practice. And for the whole building, everything to function well. But as long as we're holding the notion that we're doing this so that we will have a clean surface here or whatever, and we don't understand this moment. We don't understand engagement in this moment. That is the issue. That is just simply to be here and in taking care of this moment. We take care of all these other things as well. But this is to maintain silence then. Just to do it. I remember there was another fellow. There was one place where I was staying. And we were like the only two Western people. There was a place where Western folks would show up from time to time. But anyway, we were there and the monk assigned us to, the assignment was to sweep and then dust. And this young fellow, this Western or British fellow, he said, well, shouldn't we dust first and then sweep? Because he's like, when you're dusting, you're kind of knocking things on the floor and stuff, and then you want to sweep it up. And well, the monk who was giving us the direction just kind of stood there with his mouth open. He couldn't believe that somebody would even, first of all, come back with something, or that you're even sitting there thinking about it. Just go ahead and do the assignment. Don't spend too much time thinking on it. And since then, I've told this story many times, and people have debate. Well, you know, it really makes more sense to sweep first and then dust. I mean, and there's reasons for it, and then there's others that have arguments for it. Well, you should dust first and then sweep. I remember years and years ago, there was actually a debate going on about which way to hang the toilet paper on the wall, whether you want the toilet paper to come over the top of the roll, you know, or down over the back against the wall kind of thing, you know. And, of course, you can make your arguments, you know, like, well, when it's hanging forward, and you can grab it. So all the different arguments that we can make about this. It seems kind of silly. But how often do you catch yourself just debating something in your own mind that maybe is not even, it's just inconsequential? Or you can do it this way, and it works pretty well. You do it that way, it works pretty well. Living in Japan, you know, for a while, and everything was so different. I was surrounded by people who didn't assume what I assumed, didn't think the way I thought, did everything in a different way. It seemed that way anyway. After a while, it gets kind of maddening. You can even think, this is crazy. These people are stupid. This is nuts. This is foolish. You know, I kind of got to that point at one point. And then, and I was remembering, I was riding on the train. And I was looking around, and everything was functioning quite well. Everything was nice and clean, moving along. There were nice rice paddies and things passing by. It looked beautiful. Everything was functioning beautifully, perfectly. There wasn't any one way to do these things. Here's a whole culture that was functioning quite well, highly civilized, functioning quite well, but just doing everything in a different way. Well, it kind of teaches us a lot, I think, if we just open up to that and realize that things don't have to be done. So if we get all the way down to the point where we're obsessed over which way the toilet paper roll is hung on the wall, and we don't realize how we're stuck in this way. This is not to practice in silence. This is practicing with a very noisy mind. Of course, it's true that maybe on occasion this is the way things should be done. You know, this, because this could lead to a disaster. You know, and this, you know, these things also occur. It's true. But even so, if we learn to practice in silence, maybe not commenting so much, but just looking at things, also being open to the fact that we might be judging this all wrong. We don't fully understand the situation we're in. We might be wrong. We think that this is so right, and yet it still could be wrong. We need to remain open to this and looking at this. Also, as things unfold and happen that seem so terrible for the moment, but nothing ever stops. Things keep changing and developing, moving around, flipping over. Nothing stays put. Through all of this, and then trying to keep it correct, well, this is the way we should do that, and that's the way this should be done, etc., we're putting our mind in the wrong place. Certain actions need to be done. Okay, let's go ahead and act. But first, let's see if we're present with what is taking place. This is the practice in silence. This is the practice of Sushin, that we're not doing it for some other purpose than to be here being present. Of course, in Sushin, we limit our activity to just a few things. That gives us a great opportunity just to see how busy our minds are, reaching for one thing, grasping for another. But here we have this wonderful opportunity to practice in silence, to observe our own noisy, busy mind. Realizing, you know, what this noisiness, this busyness is coming from. Our thinking, our calculating, our grasping one thing or another. Beginning to notice that every time we do this, we have stepped out of this moment. The Sushin is about learning to step back into it. Just to come back to this. So the work period comes up, and now, if we're in this moment, we just go ahead and do it. The work leader asks you to polish this windowsill, whatever it is. Just go ahead and do it. You think you have a better idea? That's all right. Go ahead and do what the work leader said. Never mind that. Maybe later, if it really is a good idea, you can mention it to him later, huh? If it's so important. Otherwise, just go ahead and take care of this moment. Do just that. So, the lamps are flickering. Maybe they're about to go out. Many ways, if we keep silent, that we can take care of this, if it even needs to be taken care of. And it might be that it doesn't even need taking care of. So much of what we do that we feel like we have to grab this or take hold of that or change that, really doesn't even need to be done. And by learning to cultivate a mind of silence, we can more adequately see, you know, what's really necessary. Very little is necessary. Actually, the only thing that's really necessary is that we remain awake. So this is that first monk. Fix those lamps. Those lamps need fixing. And the second pupil, now very surprised to hear the first one say something, he says, "We're not supposed to say a word." "Well, then why are you talking if we're not supposed to say a word?" So immediately, when we come out of the moment, we don't realize what we're doing. If this is about not talking, then why are you talking? Why are you saying not to talk? maybe there's a moment where it's appropriate to say not to talk. You know, we say it before we come in. We put the sign up there. Also not to read. Well, you can read that sign, but then let it go. You don't write anything. Yeah, well, you can write your name on the Dokusan list, you know. And there might be these moments where maybe there's a word is okay. But otherwise, you know, we don't talk. But is it necessary now? Someone has said something. Now, is it necessary to say we're not supposed to talk? It's really the job of that person. And if it's you, then just do your job. This is about, you know, just watch your own mind. More than not to say anything. And like in the case of this fellow here, getting kind of caught up with rules. We have this rule here. You know, we're not supposed to talk. Somebody's talking, broken the rule. Well, what is it with this matter of the rule? Is it a rule? Not supposed to talk. Why are we not talking? Is it so that we can follow this rule, obey this rule? Then the rule becomes, what, some kind of cosmic law here? Not to talk. If we're going to try to maintain silence, do sashin in silence, maintain this silent mind, that as I mentioned on occasion, might say a word or two, if it's appropriate, and still be silent. But if we're going to do this, we cannot do this if we're just obeying a rule. If we're obeying a rule, sooner or later, that rule is going to get broken. But if that rule is broken because somebody's breaking the rule, well, now we've got a problem. And people get pretty upset. And of course, the people at Sashin, many of them think, well, this is the rule, so we're obeying a rule not to talk. And then the rule gets broken, and we get upset. We should understand, first of all, if we have a rule, the rules are going to be broken. No matter what, they will be broken. But it is also possible, as the Dalai Lama said, I think he said this somewhere, if you really understand the rule, or what it is that we're doing here, then you can break it properly. If we break the rule properly, that's not breaking the rule. You see, but if we have this idea, you know, that not well, we must be silent. So we're maintaining the silence because it was dictated to us that we have to maintain this silence. Then it's impossible to carry this out with a silent mind, you know, with a mind that isn't talking, jabbering. It's impossible to maintain that, and sooner or later, actual physical reality will. Reveal that this rule has been broken, and it gets broken again and again, repeatedly. So we have to understand a little deeper understanding of this, that the not talking comes out of our own heart, not out of something imposed on you from the outside. Of course, coming here to Sashin, we do impose it, and it does kind of come down as a rule, don't talk. But you don't have to take it up that way. I really don't want you to take it up like that. I want you to maybe consider, why don't we talk? At some point, if we look at this carefully, we realize what's... And we're going to be looking at this more, too, as we get into this a little bit. But look at the shifts and changes that are occurring in your mind when you talk. If you could just be compassionate with yourself, kind with yourself, as well as everybody else here at Sashin, you wouldn't do this. You would see that this matter of talking, as soon as we talk, as soon as we say anything, particularly as soon as we reach beyond something as simple as, please pass me the scissors, immediately the mind gets kind of jostled, starts to reach for things, starts to think, grasp. So the point in Sashin then is not that we make this rule not to talk. It isn't about the rule. The point here is about, are we present in this moment or not? Are we awake or are we not? You cannot arrive at this awakened state by way of a rule. we can only arrive at this when this understanding is actually in your own heart and mind. It is coming right out of your own heart and mind. That you understand why not to talk directly, as opposed to having somebody telling you not to talk. At that point, it also becomes much easier not to talk. And when somebody else talks, fix those lamps. You can remain tolerant of that. You can just kind of let it go by. It's all right. Eno's job anyway. Even the Eno can let it go by. Up to a point. Then maybe there's a point where somebody needs to say something. You know, that's probably not your job. Your job is to watch your own mind. It doesn't matter if somebody else is jabbering away. Yeah, but if it's a rule, then we feel like we have to get in there. And then what? Punish that person? Or what? Straighten them up somehow? Maybe feel a little superior? Because I'm not talking. That's kind of like this last guy here. I'm the only one. Yeah. Well, then the third guy here, he says, you two are stupid. I don't know, are they stupid? Why? Because they broke the rule? You're stupid. It's a simple rule and you're stupid. You can't even follow that simple rule. I don't know, what's he thinking? Is he thinking that? I don't know. But he says, you two are stupid. Why did you talk? Well, I don't know. Are we ever going to get to the bottom of that one? Why did you talk? Or was he asking that question so that these first two would reflect on what they just did? Well, what's going on here? And he says, why did you talk? Well, of course, this is judgment. You two are stupid. Why did you talk? There's judgment going on here. Again, this is a noisy mind. It finally, it's just ready to come out of the mouth at some point. But this is what goes on in our mind. Our mind is very noisy already before we would speak in this way and full of judgment. But you know that you cannot sit sashin, you cannot sit in zazen, you cannot sit in meditation with a judgmental mind. You cannot do that. Because in order to have a mind of judgment, you can't be here. Your mind has separated you, pulled your ego out of this moment. Now it's formed. Here it is. And something else is over there. And now you're judging it. You've created this gap. And now we can judge. Of course, very often, when it involves the ego in a very strong way like that, it's easy to condemn the other. Put them down. You're stupid. Of course, we can judge in the other way too. Put somebody up. That's also very foolish. And we shouldn't do that. I don't care who the person is. You put somebody up, you don't realize that we're all on the same floor all the time. Whether they appear like a Buddha or a scoundrel, doesn't matter. We're all on the same floor. That's the reality that we're always in. Only in our minds do people go up. When do they come down? Crashing through the floor, getting up on a pedestal. Sometimes we think that of ourselves, either way, up or down. But we certainly think it of others. Or a situation, even. This session is... No, it's no good. I've had better sessions. We judge. We judge anything. But what I want you to understand here, this is not sitting in silence. This is not maintaining silence. This is not reminding yourself to be silent. And it is also not to be here. It is to do work that is different from what we do at a session, which is to collect the mind to bring yourself right here. You cannot do that and carry judgment with you at the same time. The mind that is awake and present in this moment is not judging. Because judging involves artificially creating something here, and then more than that, well, actually that's enough right there, but very often that extra thing comes along, which is really not necessary. we add value. You know, we ascribe a certain value, you know, to what it is that we've judged, for good or bad. And this is a complete abstraction, a complete removal from just being here present in this moment. To a Buddha, they say, diamonds are dung. Doesn't matter. It's just this. Each has their place, you know. And we think diamonds are better than dung, you know, more valuable, you know. But if you're starving and you've got some dung here, you might be able to use it in your garden. What good are, under certain circumstances, what good are diamonds? You see, so there could be a situation where this dung might seem more important to you. Does that make it better? No, then no. In the case of diamonds, by the way, too, diamonds actually are not so rare. We artificially make them rare so we can drive up their price. Now, this is something that we create. We create it through our own thinking, through our own grasping. But all the while that we're engaged in this way, we're not present. We're not present with what is going on. And so Shin and this practice is about learning to just be here and to realize all these various ways in which we remove ourselves from the present moment, take ourselves out of here, that we make our minds noisy. So the silence goes way beyond just this matter of talking. Well, then finally, we get to this third one here. Yeah, you two are stupid. Why did you talk? And then finally we get to the fourth guy. Now what if the fourth fellow didn't say anything? I am the only one who has not talked. Well, that's no longer true, is it? But what if he didn't say anything? What if you're in this situation and everybody now has blown it except you? And you're just sitting there. You getting kind of proud? Or can you just sit there and no comment? That incident has passed and you remain silent, even in your own mind. No comment about yourself. Because see, there, all three of them, they blew that one. We end up forming ourselves now. Seeing ourselves in contrast with all of that out there. That's once again, well, passing judgment certainly, and that comes as I just mentioned. We've pulled ourselves out of the actual experience of the moment. Carrying on as if this were important. They talked, they didn't talk, they blew it, they didn't blow it. That has nothing to do with you and your awakening. Why do we sit Sushin? We sit Sushin thinking that at a later date we will become enlightened. Yeah, that's a very common idea. Well, what about this moment? If you want to be awake, you have to be awake now. Notice your own thinking, your own mind, and what is taking place in this moment. This is what our work is, to come back to this again and again. That this kind of pride, you know, I am the only one who has not talked. This pride in our that we might take in our practice, or I am a Zen guy, you know. Well, so what? You know, for most people on earth, that's doesn't mean a darn thing. In fact, probably looks kind of stupid. You're what? You sit and face the what are you? You know, it seems crazy. But we can take pride in it. We pull ourselves out of the moment and we take on some kind of identity. I'm a Buddhist, you know. Other people, I'm a Christian, or I'm a Muslim, I'm this. Look at all the trouble this causes. You know, why? Besides, are you this or that? How do you know? What does that even mean? Are you every moment that way? How about when you're just completely obsessed in anger at some moment, screaming your head off at someone? Now are you this or that? Or you're lost in some reverie? What are you really? So we have no room here to take pride in anything. But this practice, if we were to really understand this practice that we come into here during Sushin, called the practice of egolessness. This is about just watching our own mind and nothing more. our usual way is, yeah, we've already formed this self, and now out of this self, we carry ourselves into the world, and just kind of push ourselves onto other things, assert ourselves in one way or another. Even if it's that we're kind of withdrawn from the world, it still could very well be coming out of a sense of self. Dogen said, this is when we convey ourselves, to the 10,000 things. All that stuff out there, and we assert ourselves against that in one way or another. And he says, this is delusion. And this is to not be in the present moment. Rather, for all these things to come forward and confirm you. Well, to confirm the self, using Dogen's words. But this is the true self. It isn't really you at all. Because you aren't anything in particular at all. But it's just that in any given moment, all things confirm this right here, this moment right here, the true self. Which is your life, inseparable from the life of the world itself, from all beings. So we can't take pride with that. Because it really means that there's no you to be separated out from the other. That can now take pride. You've done it a little better than they did or whatever. There's just simply no room for that. But our practice is, if we're actually carrying out this practice, we carry it out in this way. We can't carry it out with ego. To the extent that we do, the ego is still there and we're still operating out there. We're trying to get something out of this practice. We're following the rules. Judgment is there. But that's not this practice. That's not what this is. Of course, this is so natural for us to be that way. I understand that. And we all slip into that. Me too. But this practice is about learning to see what we're doing there. Catch ourselves when we grasp, when we form a self. We should understand how quietly, silently, this practice goes on. Were we to really take it up. And with a mind like this, now we can sit Sushin without too much difficulty. But the noisy mind, very difficult to sit a Sushin. Pretty hard to keep that up. One of the difficult things about a one day like this, one days aren't really Sushins. Because in a way, we only give ourselves enough time to stir our minds up. But if you come back to this the next day, and the next day, and the next day, after a few days, then your mind starts to get quiet. And you might think, well, my mind's pretty quiet now. Well, maybe, But it comes and goes. But were we to really take this up and really do this session, we'd be doing it with a very quiet mind. We'd be sitting, really present with the moment. Maybe I can give an illustration here that might give you a sense, because I think you can kind of imagine this. My teacher used to talk about sitting like a frog. The frog just sits on a lily pad, just sitting there. And then see maybe one drop of water lands on his head and the frog blinks one eye. Just one blink, he says. And he's just sitting there again. And the fly lands. The frog gets it. Frog's really tuned in. Well, why? Why is a frog so tuned in like that? And we're not. You have any idea? The other day, I happened to notice, I was up in my office, and I was looking down out of the window. I just happened to see a cat. A neighbor's cat was out in our garden, sitting there kind of hiding behind the remains of the dillweeds there that were back there in the garden. And Jean, my wife, I heard her going out the door, which was on the opposite side of the house from the garden. And as soon as the door opened, I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. Now, I was looking at the cat. As soon as Jean opened the door, the cat was kind of looking off toward the center over here. But all of a sudden, one ear swiveled over toward our house. One ear, swivel. Cat was still looking this way, though. Well, then as Jean was kind of coming around the side there and maybe through the gate or whatever, now all of a sudden the cat's head turns to look in the direction where Jean would be coming from. And it wasn't until finally when Gene came around the corner of the garage there, anyway, in view of the cat, suddenly the cat bolts, you know, runs out of the garden. But very interesting. Here's this cat just sitting there, looking in a different direction. And a kind of relatively distant noise at that point. Very subtle noise, it was on the far side of the house. But the cat's ear swiveled. Do you ever think about how, and I've observed our cats on other occasions, so no doubt you have too with animals, how tuned in they are to their environment. Why do you suppose that is? They seem to be more tuned in than we are. You have any idea why? Well, picture this for a moment. Just think about it. You know, the cat sitting there in the garden isn't really thinking about a lot of stuff. Yeah? We're sitting here in Sashin, and look at your mind. Look how much thought, emotion, feeling just rising up all the time. We all know this. We experience it. But I suspect the cat probably doesn't have that much coming up. Probably some stuff, I suppose. You know, I have an interesting book. It's called The Animal Minds. It's very interesting. But the minds of animals are different than ours. Of course, we don't know those firsthand because we have a human mind, but we certainly know how busy the human mind is. But we can imagine for a cat or a frog just sitting there. Well, say like if we have the radio on, we're listening to the radio. But the cat or the dog, whatever, they're not listening to the radio. Years ago, I had a phonograph record of birds, you know, just birds out in the woods, you know. And my brother came over one time with his dog, and the dog was just going crazy, you know, with the birds. Going around the phonograph thing, you know, trying to get behind, trying to find where these birds were, you know. But apart from that, you can play the radio, listening to the radio or whatever. They're tuned into a different environment. They're tuned into, you know, what is right there because they're not thinking. That's what it is. We sit here in this Sashin and we're thinking. We're grasping, we're reaching, we're forming ideas and notions in our mind all the time. And of course, that grand one is me. Here I am. And we're concerned about this me now. Calculating now, how can I get the kind of things I want? And of course, we probably have a whole storyline about why I'm doing this Sashin. But we miss, I've talked with hundreds of students over the years now, and most of the time we miss this, that what the Sashin is about. Finally, it took me some time to learn this, but it's about just simply being here and watching when you get noisy in your mind. Realize what that is. Realize that now you've just stepped out of this moment. Taste just once the freedom that comes with actually just learning to be here, just stepping into this moment and truly being here in this moment. Letting the 10,000 things, the sound of the truck, you know, the chirp of the bird, whatever it is, just to define you, not as your ego self, but as just this, what is taking place here now. Without judgment, nothing to judge. You don't need to say anything about someone else, in your mind even. Or how the Sashin is going, any of these things. If something in this moment calls for your attention, your immediate action, whatever, please pass the scissors, whatever it is. Well, then engage that and do that. And you can do that if you're really present, like the frog suddenly snatching the fly that lands nearby. Because just being completely present in the moment. You know, I was going to refer to this other story. I think it's probably in this book here somewhere. There's a lot of references to this here and there, though. The fellow who's hanging by a vine or something over a cliff or something like that, and he's hanging by his teeth. You know that one? You're condemned if you say something, and you're condemned if you don't. Now speak. What are you going to say? Do you know that if we understand sound and silence, that you can speak, that you're, in fact, always speaking. And that everything is speaking. And everything is speaking to you. Dogen talks about how the valley speaks. Have you ever noticed, have you ever stood on a silent valley in the wilderness, say, where you have a large expanse out in front of you? And it is the sound of the valley. It is a beautiful phrase, it is a beautiful piece. The color of the peak, the sound of the valley. All are Shakyamuni's figure. But if you just listen to the sound of the valley, more than the sight, the sound will give you the depth of that valley. Sound gives you distance. You can hear the distance. Of course, we can see further than we can hear. But that valley, just that empty space, just that huge space, it speaks to us. But everything is speaking to us. But if we're sitting here jabbering, you know, not like a cat, but just sitting here jabbering to ourselves, we don't hear what anything is saying. We don't hear the door on the far side of the house, but we don't hear anything. Because the voice that is much louder to us is our own mind just cranking away with some notion, some idea. And what it cranks away with isn't even real. It isn't true. It's full of judgment and separation, and it's not true. There's no separation and there's nothing to judge. But we live out our lives like this. Rarely do we ever taste the freedom of just learning to sit down here and being present in what is taking place. But that's what this practice is. And at some point, maybe we can learn to do this. I want to read this other little story here at the end. I just happen to say it's called The Silent Temple. Story 100 in this book. It's kind of interesting. It's Shōichi was a one-eyed teacher of Zen, sparkling with enlightenment. He taught his disciples in Tofuku Temple. Day and night, the whole temple stood in silence. There was no sound at all. Even the reciting of sutras was abolished by the teacher. His pupils had nothing to do but meditate. When the master passed away, an old neighbor heard the ringing of bells and the recitation of sutras. Then she knew Shōichi had gone. Isn't that beautiful? He wanted, out of compassion, no doubt, he wanted his students just to taste this freedom. Of course, doing it in just kind of a literal silence, in a literal way. It might be a little extreme, but not a bad practice, really. Pretty hard for us, because you know we can only do it for so long here, and we have to go out, go to work, take care of one thing or another. But this silence is really about this maintaining silence. It really has nothing to do with whether or not we chant the sutras or ring the bells or talk. In that little book, the captions by Suzuki Roshi that's come out a while ago, where there's this great one where Suzuki Roshi told everyone, do not move, you know. And after a pause, and he said, of course, that doesn't mean you can't move. You know? Well, same thing here with silence. But silence doesn't mean you can't speak. Realize that everything is speaking all the time, and you are speaking too. But that speaking that you do, even actual verbal speech, can be done in silence. The sound and the silence, we talk about what is the sound of one hand clapper, what is the sound of the bell, the ringing of the bell. You know, Dogen talks about that. What's ringing? Is the bell ringing? What is ringing? Air is ringing. And Dogen just says ringing. You see, there's nothing in particular that's happening here that owns anything, that's doing anything. And yet all this is being done. And this silence is going on with the sound. And the sound is going on with the silence. The sound of one hand clapping, we say, well, it doesn't make any sound. It's silent, but that's the sound. We think that silence is contrasted with sound, that it's separate from sound. No, there's sound in the silence, and there's silence in the sound. That these two are not two. And so, if we understand it in this way, we can make sound and be silent. And we can be silent and make sound. Another time I remember my teacher, he said, you bring a corpse into the room, say we have a dead body here. We say it's silent. Yeah, there's no sound. But that corpse would be speaking in a deafening silence to us, reminding us of all kinds of things about this reality, the impermanence. So when we look at things in this way, the reality of our lives is such that it's our conceptualizing mind that will say, oh, it's just that, utter silence, or there's sound. We have the work to do, and the work is to get this done. We don't realize that it's, we always have the whole thing. It all takes place in totality. One thing isn't removed or separated from another. And that goes for you as well. This is the reality of our life. But when we're caught up in the noise of our own mind, in the chattering of our own mind, in the grasping of our own mind, we don't hear this. We don't see it. We don't feel it or understand it. And that's where we are most of the time. So Shin gives us this opportunity to realize that this other way that's very hard to speak of, very hard to say anything about, because it isn't anything in particular. It isn't anything that we can grasp. It is a matter of us learning to settle down into this moment and to just see what is taking place here. And to realize what it is that our mind is forming one thing, setting it off against another, and what it means to just let that go. Just one more way in which the Buddha, you know, when the Buddha summed up his teaching in various ways, in very laconic phrases, but one of the things he said was, he said, I just teach two things. Dukkha and release from dukkha. And this release from dukkha is just release from that which is formed and held by the mind. This is the practice in silence, and yet formed things are there all the time, occurring all the time, making noise. And yet if we really hear the Dharma that is being spoken, the true Dharma, the reality that's being spoken in this moment, it's always coming out of silence, right there, even in the middle of noise. And we can hear that even through all the noise, if in our own mind we practice in silence. Okay, well, I probably said enough about this, but do you have any questions?
The one thing I always had the most difficulty with in session, and part of it is because of a lot of laziness in myself, the work period, I always hated it. That's when my mind really kicks and screams, and I wanted to walk out before. And it seems to be the most confusing part of the session for me. It's gotten better after years of going through what feels like hell sometimes. I don't know why my mind does that.
Yeah. Well, it's very natural. A lot of people feel that, I think. But don't see the work period as we're here to get something done. You're given a job and it isn't to get... Now, this doesn't mean that you do a sloppy job. Do the best job you can. But it isn't about getting it done. It's about taking care of this moment. If you take care of this moment, you will do a good job. Or at least the best job you could do. You don't need to compare it with anyone else. But also, you can also do it free from the kind of obsessive thought that otherwise tends to come after you, see. Well, you create it, you bring it up. But this is a way of working without it. So just go ahead and just do it. So the work leader says, do this, just go ahead and do it. Don't argue with it in your own mind. I really don't expect you to argue with the work leader, you know, but even in your own mind, don't argue. Just go ahead and do it. I don't think the work leader is going to assign something so dangerous or deleterious to the center here that it shouldn't be done. I have every confidence in both our work leaders here. And you can always bring something up later, but just go ahead and do it. See, that's the mind we need to watch for. I have a better way, you know. Well, okay. Better than what? The best way is just to go ahead and do it without kicking and screaming. So that's all. But just see if you can try that. You notice yourself saying something to yourself. Just see if you can let it go. Does it matter? Doesn't it all come out to like arguing about which way the toilet paper roll is strung over the, you know? Yeah. In the end, does it matter? You know, does it matter? A week later, does it matter? And yes, you know, look how we get caught up in one thing or another. And just a day or two later, it doesn't matter. You don't even remember what it was. This is bondage. I mean, we put ourselves in there with our own thinking. So, best way, you know, when you come and do a sesshin, just kind of do it like you're deaf and dumb. You know? And deaf, just perk up when the work leader gives you the assignment. And I'll just go deaf again and just go ahead and do it. And, you know, with full attention. It's that internal commenting that you want to be watching for. There's a time, of course, when we need to think and to make a judgment about one thing or another. Okay, but then if we're really present and clear, we'll know when that time is appropriate and right, and we can take it up because it needs to be done in this moment, and then we'll let it go again. If the moment now calls for you to sit and think and ponder something, well, then do that, but do it wholeheartedly, totally. And when the time has passed, let it go. Just be present again, just like the cat sitting in the garden, really present, tuned in to what's taking place. You know, we don't lose our intellects that way, but we also don't engage them when it's not necessary. It saves a lot of energy and even keeps us smarter. The biggest foolishness we can get into is when we use our intellects badly. A lot of times we think that, well, I'm not such an intellectual person. Well, yeah, but you're thinking and you're grasping and you're conceptualizing. We all do that. And most of the time it's foolishness. You know. So if we learn not to engage it too much, then it becomes sharper as to when it's appropriate time, you know, and, you know, to really engage, you know, the thinking. But when the work leader assigns you something, you don't need to engage it there. Just go ahead and do it. And you'd be surprised what you can get done and how much more relaxed and quiet it'll be and the better job that you've done in the process. This is something you can take into other aspects of your life as well. Yeah, John.
I was going to say, there's sort of a tradition that doing the worst possible job is the greatest opportunity. So cleaning toilets, you know, where you have the most resistance, is a chance for you to find out where you're really at. And so that's all I mean. It's, you know,
yeah.
Whatever brings up our resistance is a way for us to find out.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And of course, I don't think we need to go out of our way to find things that, you know, that we resist, because they always
come. I couldn't tell it was a pen.
Yeah, me too. I had that assignment. Yeah. It was a great opportunity to watch your mind, because I didn't like that whenever I was assigned that, and I was assigned that a lot. But you just go ahead and do it. And never mind what you're feeling or thinking. You can learn to do that. It's a lot easier. But I was going to say, yeah, you really don't need to go looking for the things, you know. And so you get a job that, oh, I like this job. I'm really glad. You know, all right, fine. But you just, okay, then do it. You don't need to say anything. And if it's the other way, oh, I don't like that. It doesn't matter. you'll probably get, if you just leave it alone, you'll probably get a, you know, your fair share as things randomly get dispensed in the universe. You know, you'll get your fair share of both. Or also the neutral stuff as well. Our practice is to walk a steady line. Just put one foot in front of the other. Every once in a while we get thrown for a loop. You know, we step off a little bit. Okay, the mark of our practice is to get back up and take another step now. And don't judge yourself because you were just thrown for one there. That's all right. It's pretty normal. We all do that. How long do you want to keep kicking and screaming about that now? You know, we'll just stop and just get back on the path. And that's what our practice is. So no matter what comes along, something's delightful, enjoy it. Fine. You know, and I would say enjoy it. You don't have to feel guilty about enjoying something now that's come along that you happen to like. Go ahead and enjoy it. I've known people who practice like, well, they deprive themselves of what they want, what they like, you know. And they will load on, you know, hard practices. You know. Well, that's not really necessary. This is about walking with an even pace and an even step, no matter what comes. Because it all comes, if you let it. Just let the 10,000 things come up to you, whatever they are, and see if you can just take the next step. We learn to do this, you know, even death. Sooner or later it'll come up and wink right in your face. Just see if you can take another step. Yeah. Actually, death is sitting there winking around us all the time anyway, you know, but you can find that out by learning to be in this moment. Okay, anything else? Okay, thank you.